for a Verdict, brought to you by Sputnik Africa.
Welcome back to the After Verdict podcast with your host Victor Anakin. And in the wake of Vladimir Putin's recent interview with Tucker Carlson, the world has been buzzing with analysis, speculation and concern. Was it a genuine attempt at dialogue or calculated move on the global chessboard? What did Putin's statements reveal about Russia's economic and political strategies? And what are the potential consequences for the undergoing conflict in Ukraine and the wider international landscape? To delve deeper into these critical questions, we've assembled two esteemed experts. First up is Mika Takiso Kubayi from the Institute for Global Dialogue, associated with the University of South Africa. He's a research fellow at the Institute for Pan-African Thought and Conversation and a doctoral candidate of political studies at the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of Johannesburg. And then following him right up is Professor Larry Amusan, Professor of International Relations of Northwest University from Nigeria. And with these two esteemed gentlemen, I hope to get an academic breakdown of Tucker's interview with Russia's president. We'll cover a number of topics, ranging from the overall mood of the interview down to details like certain metaphors that were used. So join us to take a closer look at the most popular and trending interview on the web. Let's go. Mr. Kubayi, welcome once again to the AfroVerdict podcast, and as always, thank you for joining me. So last night, Tucker Carlson released his interview with Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Let's start off with your general perception on the interview now that you've seen it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Nugent, for inviting me once again to your podcast. Wow, it was a very interesting interview. It was very, very interesting. I mean, very detailed, very long, you know, and detailed. I appreciated the fact that President Putin went into the history, you know, of the relations with, you know, Ukraine, and to give, you know, a very, you know, good context. Well, at least, you know, what he thinks, you know, is, you know, the context. You know, so it makes it better, you know, and easier, you know, to understand where he's coming from, you know, on this, to understand what, you know, the position of Russia is on the issue. So I think his approach was a very good one. I thought, you know, it's always good to give a historical background, you know, for it. It was a really, really good one, I thought.
Yeah, totally agree with you. And I mean, I saw there was some backlash and memes online about Putin, like Tucker Carlson asked him, so what were reasons for engaging in the whole Ukrainian conflict? And Putin starts to give him a 20-minute lecture on history. But despite that being somewhat comical, like you said, it is important, the whole history behind it. I mean, you can't expect him to give a one sentence answer. I did it because what I had to, you know what I mean?
Well, for an issue as important as this, you know, punchlines, you know, are not what you want. You want an explanation. You want to go deep into the reasons why, you know, decisions were taken, and they were taken in the manner in which they were. You want a thorough, deep, you know, conversation about it. You want a serious conversation like President Putin puts it, because it's just that important. It deserves a serious, you know, consideration. It deserves a thorough, deep dive, you know, into, you know, all the issues, the root causes of things, you know, the origin, you know, of you know, by the challenges. Go into everything. And of course, you know, but you have to understand, even 2 hours is not enough, you know, to do proper justice, you know, to the full history, you know, of all of the things that have happened there. And of course, yes, I mean, it was more than correct, you know, to approach it in that manner. First, give, you know, by the historical background, you know, where things started, you know, how they've evolved to the point that they are, you know, now. It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing at all. It's actually a very good thing. I think the problem, my brother, that we are facing now is that for the longest time, Russian media, right? Russian media or any news source or any news coming out of, you know, Russia or with a Russian perspective has essentially been blocked in so many avenues and on so many platforms. You know, it's as if, you know, no one coming out of Russia is supposed to say anything or hold an opinion at all. You know, and then suddenly, boom, you know, here you have, you know, Tucker Carlson, you know, by granting this interview. And, you know, the whole world is able to hear President Putin for themselves firsthand. You know, and it's a shocker because it hasn't happened since the beginning. I mean, people would only maybe say, you know, if they're lucky enough to access RT, for instance, you know, online. Or maybe, you know, some of those, you know, it's been generally difficult to get, you know, up to date, you know, current news from conventional media coming out of Russia. Yeah, no, so it's been a ban. It's as if it's been a battle of, what is it, information, you know, so to speak. Ban everything that comes out of Russia and pump the world, you know, with everything that comes out of, you know, Western media. You know, and that is the I think the cause of the shock right now. I mean, it wasn't quite expected. You're hearing even stories about, you know, penalties for Tucker Carlson for even doing this interview. I thought overall, I mean, it was a decent interview. I thought it was a good interview. President gave his account. Tucker Carlson asked what he wanted to know. I thought it was a good interview.
You know, you mentioned that there were notions that the European Union was going to impose sanctions on him, something like that. But apparently that's been refuted. Well, I'm not sure if they will impose sanctions in the future. That's quite undetermined. But I saw, for example, John Kirby, the White House official, saying that Americans that decided to listen to the interview shouldn't take it seriously and sort of should take it with a grain of salt, not believe everything that Putin says. And then Hillary Clinton calling Tucker Carlson a useful idiot for Putin. I mean, what image does that paint of a country that is that supposedly promotes freedom of speech when there's an opportunity to hear the other side and then, you know, officials of the state, they go and say these things?
Well, it's unfortunate. That is why, for instance, I said earlier that, you know, by anything coming out of Russia or anything of with a Russian perspective, you know, had been essentially sidelined, which is unfortunate because it deprives, you know, of the people an understanding of what is going on in the thinking, you know, of Russian policymakers and leadership, you know, what is happening. So people can then understand and make a balanced view, you know, and hold a balanced view of, you know, it is that ought to be done and what help is needed, you know, by the world to bring about peace. It's unfortunate. But I would say, out there say, look, the train has left the station, right? You know, you can say, you know, take what Putin says as with a grain of salt. Don't, you know, Carlson is a useful idiot, as you've just mentioned, quoting others. But people will watch. And people will reason and people will think, you know, about what President Putin has said. They will take it and consider it seriously. The world population is not made up of idiots, you know, as you've said, Madam Clinton, you know, would have referred to Tucker Carlson. People are thinking, people are accessing information, people are reading, people are thinking, you know, they're reflecting, they're evaluating things, they're reviewing things, you know, and they will be thinking about this as well. You know, they are not going to be sitting there. And I mean, if you look at, for instance, what is happening in the United States today, I mean, take the case of what is happening with Palestine and Israel. You know, conventional media isn't able to suppress, you know, views anymore in the way that, you know, it used to, you know, before. It's a new world. The world is changing. To hold those old, narrow positions to say, I mean, what's wrong with President Putin speaking? What is wrong with it? Like, seriously, what is wrong with it? You know, what is wrong? Who says that if he speaks, therefore everyone will agree with him? You know, where's the danger in him speaking? There will be, of course, those that will agree with him. There will be those that won't agree with him. The issue is what it is that is fact and what isn't fact, right? The issue is here is finding a way to achieve a peaceful settlement. Yeah, you know, so that people stop getting harmed, so that people stop dying, so that we want development. That's what the world wants. What's wrong with President Putin speaking and having a say and expressing? I mean, we hear President Biden all the time. We hear all these other leaders literally all the time. You know, we're inundated with speeches, Twitter, texts, you know, and so on and so forth. We hear all of that all the time. Why not Putin? I think what Tucker Carlson has done is essentially go against, what is it, the trend, you know, so to speak, you know, and it became a bit of a shocker somewhat. It wasn't expected. Maybe even they're thinking it's brazen, you know, but what, you know, what some clearly do not, you know, want to understand is that, you know, the world is a thinking world and people are listening to what President Putin is saying and they're reflecting. They have access to information, they have access to evidence. They can make up their own minds independently.
For sure, for sure. And I noticed there's this sort of notion that Tucker Carlson, you know, he committed this mortal sin of interviewing the Russian president. What impact do you think will it have on public opinion in the West?
Well, I think it will have some impact. The extent, I don't know. It's anybody's guess, really. But what it does do, you know, is give a lot of context. What President Putin did was close a gap of information, right? That had been created by, you know, this long period, you know, of blocking media sources, media, you know, content coming out of Russia or with Russian perspective. So he has closed, you know, a lot of those holes, a lot of those gaps, you know, and people would be able to now start, because he gave him new information that, look, there were discussions, there were negotiations, there were certain agreements, there were certain signatures, there were a whole host of things in detail that happened, things that were literally essentially kept, you know, out of, you know, the mass media space. So people will certainly be reflecting on this. What they will do with it, I don't know. You know, whether or not it will sway them in one way or another, I don't know. But, you know, it certainly, you know, is something that, you know, they will have benefited from, you know, the global population. They would have had, you know, and they would now have things, you know, to reflect and things, you know, against which to judge, you know, or assess, you know, the progress so far, you know, in this special operation crisis or however it is described, depending on where you're coming from.
Yeah, for sure. Look, during the interview, Putin said that US leaders have made a strategic mistake by weaponizing the dollar against other countries. And in fact, you know what? Let's actually listen to what Vladimir Putin said during the interview.
You know, using the dollar as a tool of struggle and pressure is the United States' biggest mistake. The dollar is the foundation of U.S. power. I think everyone understands this very well. No matter how many dollars you print, they spread all over the world. Inflation in the U.S. is minimal. I think it's 3%, about 3.4%, which is completely reasonable for the United States. Yet they print endlessly, of course. What does the debt of 33 trillion say? It's a mission. Nevertheless, it is the main weapon for maintaining the power of the U.S. in the world. As soon as the political leadership decided to use the dollar as an instrument of political struggle and pressure, they struck a blow to this American might. I don't want to use any non-literary expressions, but this is foolish and a huge mistake. Look at what is happening in the world. Even among U.S. allies, dollar reserves are shrinking right now. Everyone is looking at what is happening and they are starting to look for ways to protect themselves. But if the U.S. applies restrictive measures to certain countries, such as limiting payments, freezing assets, and so on, it is a huge concern and a signal to the whole world. What has been happening in our country? Until 2022, about 80% of settlements in Russia's foreign trade were in dollars and euros. At the same time, about 50% of our settlements with third countries were in dollars, and now I think only 13%. But we did not ban the use of the dollar. We did not intend to do so. The U.S. decided to limit our settlements in dollars. I think it's absolute nonsense in terms of the interests of the United States itself, the taxpayers of the United States, because it strikes a blow to the U.S. economy. It undermines the might of the United States in the world. By the way, settlements in yuan were about 3%. Now we settle 34% in rubles and about the same amount, just over 34% in yuan. So why did the United States do this?
Well, Mr. Kobayi, back with you again. Do you agree with that statement?
It depends, you know, on the lens. It depends on where you're standing. In 1971, when the gold standard was abandoned and the oil dollar, you know, emerged, it was a very clever move by the United States at the time. I mean, it's essentially what, you know, gave it the dominance, the sort of dominance that it enjoys today. But, you know, obviously from President Putin's point of view now, you know, given that the world has changed and the world continues to change, is that that advantage is no longer there. It's now, precarious. You know, it's now precarious because people are suddenly, you know, looking at, you know, alternative ways of conducting trade and alternative ways of conducting transactions and so on, which is also healthy, by the way. I mean, a very basic, you know, analogy, my brother. I mean, look, if I was to, you know, sell you maybe, say, a shoe, I'm selling it to you. I'm not selling it to someone in Austria or someone, you know, in Switzerland or someone, you know, in Nigeria. No, I'm selling it to you, right? You and I, why must we need somebody else, a third party for it? That's, you know, one basic way, you know, of looking at, you know, trade, you know, relations and these issues around SWIFT, you know, and so on and so forth. I mean, look, the logic is you want to be able to have, you know, a trustworthy system, you know, of clearances, right? That can clear, you know, international transactions. Fine, granted, we understand all of that. But such, you know, why should it be an instrument of just one entity, one country, or one, you know, party, you know, and to weaponize it, you know, against others? I mean, it's not what it's supposed. It's not doing what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to, you know, that those systems are supposed to facilitate international transactions. Yeah, you know, Russia is clearly transacting. And he's correct. I mean, look, you know, it's not even his words, by the way. The World Bank has been saying that. Yeah, you know, by the progress that Russia has actually been making. It's the World Bank. I mean, these reports, we saw them. We saw them a while before, you know, President Putin even mentioned them. These are experts, and he's correct. It's actually Western experts who are busy saying these things, who are writing these things, who are recording the data, you know, who are analyzing the data, and who are releasing the reports. It's not him. Yeah, no, and he's correct. I mean, you know, wow, Russia is certainly transacting, you know, perhaps maybe more so now than it did even before the sanctions. Yeah, no, so then, you know, what is the point? Like, what's going on, you know, really? Other than to, you know, foment discord, you know, and things like that. The world doesn't want that. The world wants peace right now. I mean, we've had enough bloodshed, for crying out loud. The world wants peace. Yeah, you know, it wants peace. It wants, people want to be safe in their homes, in their spaces. They want to be, they want to go and, you know, go to work. They want their economies to grow. They want trade to flow, and all of that. I think, look, you know, this is a major development. It's not a small thing. It's actually a big deal. You know, you now have an official, you know, blow by blow, and a simple and clear account, you know, by the head of state of the Russian Federation, giving in detail, you know, an explanation of how Russia, you know, found itself in this position, how the decisions, you know, were taken, why they were taken, and so on, and what, you know, the Russian leadership thinks, you know, is happening in the world, you know, so it's clear, so it's undiluted, you know, without anyone, you know, having, you know, this is what Putin is thinking. This is what, no. From his own mouth. Now people have heard it from him, you know, not contextualized by someone, not diluted by someone. No, they heard it from him, you know, blow by blow from him, coming straight directly from him, not through a middleman.
Yeah.
So it's a big deal. It's a big deal. It will certainly be something, you know, to be discussed for quite some time. It's already making waves, you know, as we speak. It's already making waves.
For sure.
It was important for that kind of communication to happen because you want to give everyone the opportunity to speak. It doesn't mean that, you know, if you feel that you are correct in your argument, that the person that you think is incorrect should not be able to, that person must speak so that you can understand why they're incorrect if you think they're incorrect. And so you can try and wait and move towards, you know, something sensible, a sensible solution or a settlement of sorts.
Yeah, you can't find compromise if you don't know the other person's opinion, the other parties, yeah, what they want and how they see the whole situation. Sticking to the topic of the whole transacting thing, Putin said that now Russia makes 34 of its transactions in rubles. And just over 34% in yuan. How does this affect the popularity of the US dollar worldwide?
Some time ago, colleagues, when BRICS was talking about integrating the BRICS economies, and doing more trade, intra-BRICS trade, and so on, and the whole de-dollarization debate, started doing the rounds. I might add also, actually, that BRICS countries did not talk about de-dollarization. They spoke about trading with each other in their own currencies. It's not the same thing. It's not about the dollar. It's about themselves not needing a third party to trade with each other or to interact with each other, with one another. But in any event, even before all of that happened, the popularity of the dollar had already actually started to wane. There are some commentators who had been monitoring and observing and noticing that countries are actually, starting to feel the pinch, and the weight or the burden, the burdensomeness, of the dollar on their economies, and their instruments, for the management of their economies. So that had already been there, that had already been there. Countries' economies had already been feeling it. So it is no different now. Countries are starting to buy oil, in their own currencies. India has been buying some oil in the rupee, and so on and so forth. You'll recall, is it last year or the year before, when President Xi Jinping went to the China Arab Summit in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And it was agreed that, an oil exchange would be established, in Shanghai within 5 years. Now, what does that tell you, already at that point? That here you have, and mind you, this is the same Saudi Arabia, including the UAE, that have now joined, BRICS together with Iran. These are massive oil producing countries. These are massive oil producing economies that have joined BRICS, and they're already talking about trade, in different currencies, well, in each other's currencies, and so on. Of course, the volumes of trade done in currency other than the dollar will have an impact, will have some sort of influence. But it has to be significant trade, in order for it to essentially supplant the dollar. It has to grow, and it's growing. The reality is there. It has already started, and it will only grow. And there's nothing sinister, about it. There's nothing. It's not even an anti-American thing. It's not even an anti-dollar thing. People simply want to trade in their own currencies. It may be cheaper. It may be more efficient. So on and so forth. It may be better, for their developmental interests, their own national interests, to do so. So yes, there will be some incremental, influence. That's for sure.
As of now, the largest number of sanctions in the world are imposed on Russia compared to any other country, even Iran, who was the, so to say, the record holder. But nonetheless, Russia's become the first economy in Europe during this time, according to Putin. What does this paradox reveal about Western sanctions? And could one say that sanctions have become a tool of neocolonialism?
Well, I look at it differently, my brother. The way I see it as a world that has already began to change. Like I said earlier, I used the phrase earlier, the train has left the station, right? We're now essentially witnessing, the establishment of a multipolar world, some will say a multipolar world order, a new world order, or the world is definitely changing. No matter which way, you name it, the world is changing. It is no longer the way, that it once was, some 10, maybe 20, maybe even 15, maybe 30 years ago. The world of today, is different. So it's certainly different to what it was when the Bretton Woods institutions, were essentially, created. So some of the instruments, that were used, very effectively in those days, leading up to today, have ceased to be as effective as they once were. But it also depends on the nature of the economy, you know, that you are penalizing with such sanctions. For instance, not every economy in the world is Russia. I mean, you have to look at the economy's own, you know, internal arrangement. You know, if it can produce its own stuff, which Russia certainly can do, highly industrialized, Russia certainly is, you know, technological savvy, Russia certainly is, you know, and so on. I mean, Russia is an important economy for the global economy. It's not a small player. You know, never mind. I mean, I see the issue of, you know, the military, the potency of the military. No, before you even look at those things, just the economy alone, innovation, you know, ingenuity, you know, science, you know, I mean, for crying out loud. You know, Russia is a leader, you know, in space exploration even. I mean, there are some things that, you know, we like to deny. Maybe it's not so popular, you know, in Western media to acknowledge, but, you know, Russia actually has internal strength. So it's been able to withstand, you know, some of these shocks, you know, that, that are external. It has been able to withstand, it has been able to not only do that, but also actually thrive. It has found itself in a position to navigate, you know, and develop new pipelines, you know, of trade, new, you know, mechanisms of, you know, conducting transactions. You know, it's been able to do that. But a country like maybe, say, Mali, you know, a country, you know, it's a, like even South Africa is not even at the point, you know, that Russia is in right now. So as much as Russia, we may say, you know, has been able to withstand, you know, these sanctions, right? And the fact that, you know, the world is still changing. President Putin, you will remember, also said that the United States, in fact, you know, Western economies still have major advantages, you know, over others. And that's a fact. They do. I mean, not too long ago, you know, just last year sometime, even at the beginning of this year, when just after the announcement of this court case, you know, on at the International Court of Justice, some commentators saying this means South Africa could potentially be booted out of AGOA. It may well be. I don't know. We'll see, you know, what happens. But the reality is people still see, for instance, you know, the massive advantage that, you know, Washington has over many others. But the world, nonetheless, is moving, you know, it's changing. And countries living like South Africa are able to say, to stick to principle and say that, no, wrong is wrong, despite it. Wrong is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm totally with you there, Mr. Kubai. You mentioned pipelines, and that just got me to another question. According to Putin, Russia is ready to start supplying gas to Europe via Nord Stream 2. So whose economy has been affected more by the destruction of Nord Stream 1? Russia's or Europe's?
Mostly Germany's.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We know Europe has been struggling, especially over the winters. It's been struggling. The economy is actually on a decline. And it hasn't been performing as well as it could have. Right? There are massive problems, economic problems in Europe right now. We all know that. The data is there. You know, the evidence is there. And certainly Germany, of all countries, has been feeling the pinch. Yeah, and it's been really, really hard hit. I mean, you see now some European economies now starting to want to re-establish old coal power stations. Coal power stations that they had long abandoned.
Yeah, good luck to them with the green policies they're pursuing.
Exactly. And then now you're having to see, you know, high prices for gas. You know, the price of energy has a ripple effect on the prices of many other consumer products. Yeah, no, it has a direct impact, you know, on the cost of living. You know, and many other things. Europe has certainly felt the pinch. And like President Putin is saying, I mean, in fact, it's not even his words, it's actually those of the World Bank, you know, and others, you know, that have been assessing the data, you know, that have been monitoring. And Russia has actually been doing better. Now, imagine this. With Russia's current strength as it is right now, you know, economically, right? And in terms of industrial, you know, capacity. Imagine if you were to suddenly lift the sanctions.
No, that would be a very, very interesting development.
Russia obviously would benefit even much greater in opposition than currently is, obviously. You know, the potential, you know, of, you know, massive economic growth, you know, is there. You know, but what the strategic mistake would have been, you know, but in that you asked about this earlier, you know, that you crippled the Russian economy by imposing these sanctions. It was a mistake. What Russia did instead was focus on building its internal capacity, productive capacity. That's what it did. You know, it didn't struggle there. You know, it built capacity, ingenuity, you know, infrastructure. It was well prepared, you know, essentially for this reality. And now with this capacity, you think that Russia will let it go even with you know, sanctions being dropped? Of course not.
Yeah, and Putin openly said, like, hey, if you want gas, it's there, man. Just open the valve and take it. They're the ones that don't want it. So what does this allude to then in terms of parties who would be interested or who would have been interested in the destruction of Nord Stream?
I think it was a gamble that didn't pay off as much as perhaps it would have been expected to. I don't know if, you know, it was, you know, a short or long game, you know, that was being played, you know, with that one. If, you know, maybe in the long run, you know, is what they were, developments in the long run is what they were looking at. Or, you know, some sort of short-term gain, you know, and, you know, who is to sacrifice, you know, for the benefit of such, you know, a long-term, you know, a goal, if at all, you know, there was such, you know, a consideration. I don't know. But it was clearly something that didn't work out as well as, you know, was planned, originally envisaged. European economy struggled. The European economy is struggling. The American economy isn't as fine. It's growing, you know, but it's registering positive, you know, growth. But there was a time not too long ago where it was facing recession. Not too long ago, no, but a year or two ago. Yeah, no. So it's also not, you know, exactly firing, you know, on all cylinders either. You know, it was a strategic mistake. You know, I think, you know, this thing of wanting to exert dominance, you know, over others. You know, instead of negotiating, you know, with people, that is where the problem is. And the pride to say that, hey, look, this thing of ours hasn't succeeded. Let us try something else. It seems there's a reluctance to accept that, you know, there are other ways, better ways, you know, to achieve, you know, progress, you know, than. But, you know, there's a lot of doubling down. And the rest of us can only hope, you know, and pray that, you know, this conflict, you know, ends sooner rather than later. But, you know, we keep seeing every day, you know, I mean, look, today you've got a Senate that shot down, you know, a bill that would have given Ukraine, you know, aid, you know, to the tune of around $60 billion. Now, this would be in addition to, you know, I think, what was it? What did they announce? About 50 million billion euros that the European Union, you know, committed to over a couple of years. That when was it? Was it last week, you know, also, you know, that they concluded this and so on. But the United States is even struggling, you know, to arrive at that. Yeah, no, just that alone.
Yeah, well, for sure. I mean, you can imagine how the population feels about it. There's obviously no country is perfect, and the US also has problems within itself. And to see so much taxpayer money just getting sent overseas, and it just keeps going and going and going. Of course, the representative at the houses are gonna feel the people's dissent with that. So, yeah, there's probably, to no surprise, that the financing will come to an end soon. And you can even notice that in the media outlets, in the sort of preparing the population for the final decision. More and more outlets are saying, looks like, you know, Ukraine's not going to win, no more financing, there's more problems at home, and so on and so forth.
We simply don't know, you know, how it's going to end. What President Putin said, you know, was, look, you know, we've made our proposals. They know where we are. You know, they know how to contact us. In fact, you know, some, you know, at some levels of state, their interactions, negotiations are possible. Everyone's in, well, is open to them, except maybe some, you know, that don't want them. I don't know why they wouldn't want them, you know, and so on. We hope, you know, that, you know, some sort of sanity will prevail and an end to the conflict, you know, will come, you know, sooner rather than later, instead of risking, you know, now, you know, a conflict that will engulf the whole entire world and then set development back 200 years. In the final analysis, my brother, what happened in that interview was a very good thing, in that, you know, for the first time in a few years now, you know, the whole world got to listen to got to hear what President Putin had to say, you know, give an account, you know, of the Russian, where things are, untainted, you know, unpolluted, uninterrupted by anyone, to say that these are the developments, you know, that happened. There were negotiations, there were this, there was that. Throughout the whole process, there were, you know, attempts to negotiate a peaceful settlement. In fact, a peaceful settlement had even been arrived at, that was destroyed by others. So the important thing is, at least now the global population will be able to judge, you know, better, you know, more equipped to assess, you know, and come up, you know, with their own independent view, position on the matters. It was a very important thing. I think it would have benefited the world population a great deal.
Great, Mr. Kubai, thank you very much for joining the AfroVerdict podcast and sharing your analysis with our audience. I'm sure everyone will be very excited to hear what you have to say about this interview. So, yeah, like I said, it was great speaking to you. See you next time. Nikotakiso Kubai, thank you once again for joining me on the AfroVerdict podcast. Now moving over to Professor Larry Amusan, Professor of International Relations of Northwest University, Nigeria, to get an expert international relations outlook on Tucker's interview with the Russian president. Professor Larry Amusan, thank you so much for joining me today on the AfroVerdict podcast. And I'm truly glad to have this opportunity to discuss this important interview with an expert such as yourself. Well, let's start off with your general sort of perception of the interview overall.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invite. I really appreciate this. And this is something that's has been agitating so many people, most especially from developing areas. Like some scholars are saying that unfortunately the Western world has already captured the rest of the world, most especially in terms of economic, politics, and information dissemination. And with the opinion of Vladimir Putin and what is ongoing at the global system, it continues to generate argument that there is always an alternative to the problem that we are contending with in the international system. And as a result of that, Carlson has been crucified by so many people. And unfortunately, Hillary Clinton equally castigates the rationale behind granting interview by Vladimir Putin to an American who they believe is anti-American in every perspective. So for me, the interview is an eye-opener. It lets us know exactly what is going on in the Baltic and in the eastern part of Europe and the rationale behind why Russia is in Ukraine in order to maintain sanity in the region.
Right. So, look, from the very beginning, Vladimir Putin gave this extremely detailed historical background and geopolitical context explaining why Russia was forced to fight in Ukraine, and explained that ignoring the continued NATO expansion could have simply ruined Russia itself. What is your perception of Russia's efforts to safeguard its sovereignty?
Well, thank you very much for the question. The concept of sovereign equality of every state is even a contentious issue in the international system. Because as much as you are talking about sovereignty of your state, whatever you think that it is domestic affairs radiate to external affairs in the 21st century. If you think that because you are a sovereign state, equality before the law, every state is has the same rights in the eyes of international law. So every law, there is always a limitation. In a situation whereby you think that your domestic affairs cannot affect the international system, it's like you are no more in a global village, whereby what is happening in the remotest part of the world continue to affect the most powerful countries in the world. Now, what I'm trying to say in essence is that when you look into the concept of sphere of influence, we cannot totally delink Russia's position regarding the issue of sphere of influence. For instance, if in Mexico, in Cuba, in Argentina, let me say for the whole of the southern part of America, if any country like Russia or China goes there in order to put some position, America will immediately react into it. So we must not forget another concept of cultural irredentism. When you look into the eastern part of Ukraine, you notice that majority of the people who are in this area, most especially the Kyiv area, these are the Russian speakers. And as a result of that, you cannot leave your own people because of the cultural implication of it. And for the stability of your own country, there is no country in the world that will let his or her people die in silence. So as a result of that, what I believe is that what America is trying to do is to neutralize Russia in the global system. Why I'm saying that is that when you look into what happened immediately, the dissolution of the former Union of Soviet Socialist Republic, we have about 15 other countries that came out of former USSR. And if you see what is going on in that, in all these countries, and you see the activities of NATO in the area, like Poland, who will think that Poland will join the Western world? Remember the Warsaw Pact. The Warsaw is right in Poland. And what is actually going on now? So what I'm saying in essence is that what Russia is trying to do is to maintain the political stability of Russia as a sovereign state. That is one. Number two, in order to preserve the culture, the heritage of Russia. And number three, we mustn't forget the sphere of influence of which I made mention of. So geopolitically, there is no way America can go into the eastern part of Europe and think that Russia will never react. It is not possible, because the stability of these neighboring countries dictates the stability of Russia itself. And there is no leader in the world that will be seeing some instability next to its door and we keep quiet. So I believe what Vladimir Putin is doing is the best for the stability of Europe as a whole. So that is my take on that.
Well, speaking about the special military operation in Ukraine, Russia's president said that the country's territorial aims in other parts of Eastern Europe and the Baltic region are absolutely out of the question. Why do you believe is the West trying to paint Russia as this, hegemon country that wants to get involved in a global war?
To start with, when Vladimir Putin became the president of Russia, if it is his ambition is to recapture the former members of USSR, this thing would have been done very long time ago. The only problem is that by the time Mikhail Gorbachev negotiated with the Western world regarding the future of the Eastern Europe, it was not documented. And if it was documented, it would have been another thing entirely. It was a verbal diplomatic understanding among the respected leaders at the global level. But unfortunately, this thing was not documented. It was not put in black and white. So you cannot, if it is the intention of the Russian government to extend to spread its tentacles to the Eastern world, we would have been in another world entirely. So for you to have moved to Ukraine and you want to claim that country, you are attracting the country to the Western part by joining the European Union, by joining NATO and so many Western world inspired international organizations. It will never work because it will hinge on the stability of Russia, as I alluded to. So I don't see, from what I've been seeing so far, that Vladimir Putin is interested in expansionism of the country. So that is my take on that.
Thank
because
you.
Because if Vladimir Putin is interested in that, the military wherewithal is available for the country to have done that. It happened before in Georgia. It happened before in Odessa, of which you and I are conversant with. But for the Ukraine, it's a different thing entirely. And the involvement of America, the CIA involvement, as Vladimir Putin said, is an aggression on the stability of the Eastern Europe, of which America supposed not to have done that. America, the so-called hegemonic power in the international system, supposed to go to that to the Eastern Europe in order to resolve the problem, not to aggravate it. But the aggravation of this problem is what is causing instability, even not only in Eastern Europe. It's equally causing crisis in other developing areas, most especially when you look into the issue of food. Maybe we are going to talk about that later.
I found it interesting that the Western media presented Tucker Carlson as having committed the worst thing he could have done possibly throughout his life, this mortal sin of interviewing Russia's President Vladimir Putin. What impact do you think this event will have on public opinion in the West?
You know, it is highly unfortunate that people keep on blaming the Western power and the Eastern power during the time of USSR. That it is this USSR, South Korea, China, Cuba, and I think Venezuela, that they are the one who are the architect of covering information and taking information out of their own people. But when you see what America is doing, for instance, I give you an example. BBC in the UK is spending millions of pounds sterling every year in order to make sure that BBC is its presence in Africa is maintained at every time. So what that one implies is that with the propaganda from the Western world, you have the VOA, you have Fox, you have Deutsche Welle, you have BBC, and so many others who are trying as much as possible to make sure that the information from the Western world will be subscribed to at all costs. But at the same time, any information that is coming from other side, and as a student of international relations, you need to gauge the information and try to come up with a functional one that will promote a balanced information communication. But what Western world is trying to do is to make sure that whatever they transmit to the rest of the world supposed to be subscribed to. And that one is totally unacceptable. And as a result of that, I want to believe fervently that if America continue this way, it will get to a certain level where they are going to meet a cul-de-sac. And when they get to that, people will not believe whatever information they are trying to project to their population. Even in America, for instance, is not interested in war because of the economic crisis that is globally affecting virtually every country. But for Carlson to have gone to Moscow in order to interview Vladimir Putin, they believe that there will be so many information that they want their citizens not to consume, and trying to expose this type of alternative information, it may generate instability in America. And we should remember that American election is just around the corner. And we know that in the area of international relations, America and the other Western countries are so sensitive about it, unlike in developing areas where issue of foreign relations is very, very secondary, and they believe that it is esoteric. But this time, I believe it is timely for the Kremlin government to let the outside world know what Joe Biden and his government is trying to do in Ukraine.
Vladimir Putin also stated that despite the largest number of sanctions in the world applied to Russia, in 2023, the country was Europe's biggest economy. And according to the president, this signifies that the tools that the US uses simply do not work. What does this paradox reveal about Western sanctions? And could one say that these sanctions have become a tool of neocolonialism?
You know, sanction is something that has been generating curiosity and argument in the international system. In a situation whereby the sanction that you slam on another country is not global. Global means is that not all the country subscribes to it. Definitely, imposition of sanction to against Russia is not only affecting Russia. If you remember, European countries, they were seriously affected, most especially the supply of gas. Not only that, Asia, Africa, they suffered a lot because of sanctions, most especially when you think about grain supply. And if it would have been a credible source of punishing Russia, Russia would not have excess of grain to give to countries like Mali in West Africa, I think Afghanistan, and so many other countries. I cannot remember this at this stage. But what I believe is that Russia is technologically balanced to the extent that Russia can produce whatever they want. And don't forget, there are so many countries that are not subscribing to the sanction that's orchestrated by the United States of America. Russia is a member of BRICS. We know the attitude of, the position of China towards this issue of sanction. China as a country is very, very good at diplomacy. China will look into any country that is ready to satisfy our own demands. The same thing applies to India, South Africa, Brazil. And you remember that the last BRICS summit in South Africa, it generated some argument, the issue of the dollarization of the international system, the admission of about two or three countries as a member of BRICS. So what I'm saying in essence is that as a member of other international regime, definitely it may not affect Russia the way America and its allies wanted it to affect Russia. So in essence, this issue of sanction is not working, because you remember the issue of sanction that was imposed on South Africa during the apartheid regime. Can we say that the sanctions slammed on Pretoria by the defunct Organization of African Unity realized its objectives? The answer is no, because there are so many other countries that physically move their technology to South Africa in order to develop that country. And that is one of the reasons why South Africa is most developed in Africa. So in essence, the issue of sanction may not be achieved as it is expected by the rest of the world.
Russia's president also reminded everyone that the BRICS countries, where Russia presides this year, are developing very rapidly, and their share of the global economy is greater than that of the G7. How significant is BRICS in the context of a changing global order, and what role can it play for Africa?
No, it is very simple. When you look into the composition of BRICS, you look into the population, you look into the technological development, and you equally look into the political commitment of the members and their attitude towards America in terms of domination. Since 1945 until date, can we say that majority of other countries really benefited from America's neoliberalism? The answer may not be totally yes. Because when you look into some international financial institutions dominated by America, instead of those international financial institutions to promote economic development of the member states, like your IMF, like your World Bank, like your even African Development Banks, that was formed in Africa in 1964, which is being captured by the Western world, they cannot perform the expected roles that they're supposed to perform. So now people are tired of using dollar as a medium of exchange at the global level. So what I'm saying in essence is that now that other countries are fraternizing, when other countries are fraternizing with China, with India, definitely it is going to be an issue whereby America will remain less relevant in the geo-economics system at the global level.
President Putin mentioned that using the dollar as a weapon of political struggle is one of the biggest strategic mistakes made by the US political leadership. What do you think about this statement?
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to look into this problem from two different broad perspectives. One, the issue of decolonization of education in Africa, of which African countries are taking it very seriously. And when you decolonize your education, definitely those colonial masters who colonize Africa and who, by interpretation, are agents of America, UK inclusive, that was once colonized America before 1776, when America received its political independence from the United Kingdom. So, I mean, So, what I'm saying is that the issue of dollar as an agent of colonization or the agent of economic and political dominance of America, it continues to have challenges now. And the challenges are because of what America is trying to do in order to make sure that dollar continue to be the only unit of financial transaction at the global level. I remember, was it two years ago when India and China started to use other means in order to settle their trade balances at the global level? So with what is happening now, it's unfold a lacuna in the issue of America being the only primus inter pares in the Committee of Nations.
All right, thank you very much, Professor. Let's jump back to Europe quickly. When Vladimir Putin was answering Tucker's question about NATO or CIA involvement in the Nord Stream explosion, Putin said that, quote, "We need to look for someone who wanted and could have done it," close quote. Why do the Western countries that conduct the investigations of this act of industrial terrorism simply refuse to provide any substantial information about the parties involved in this attack?
The thing you and I should understand one thing, that the CIA, European Union, though European Union to some extent, because there is a declaration sometimes ago, about 3 weeks ago, whereby the European Union were trying to castigate America's involvement in Ukraine. That is no more acceptable. But when we are looking at the issue of terrorism, It started very long time ago. In 1973, the coup against Allende of Chile, it was orchestrated by CIA because of ITT. America will continue to make sure that our own sphere of influence will be properly guarded. That is one. Number two, America is ready to blackmail any country. America will be through its CIA to sabotage economy of other countries, and is the same country or is the same organization that we come up with a condemnation of what happened. Because whenever they want to strike, they strike in a clinical way so that you can hardly notice that this thing involves the CIA. It is only several years, maybe about 50 years, when they declassify some information that you will continue to appreciate the fact that this thing involves America itself. So in such a situation, there is no one who appointed America as a policeman in the international system. So looking into any disruption or sabotage supposed to come from the United Nations organization, even I'm not even suggesting United Nations Security Council, because United Nations Security Council is dominated by the great powers. I'm equally conscious of a fact that China and Russia are permanent members of the Security Council. But at the same time, the preponderance power of America over France and the UK cannot be overlooked in this crisis.
Prof, thank you. And lastly, the Russian president stated that the ultimate beneficiary of the biggest European media are American financial institutions. With European media still having a large presence on the African continent, how does the West use it to influence political landscape of African countries?
Yeah, like I indicated before, whatever happens in European states, most especially the European states that marry liberal system of economic development, you cannot disconnect America's involvement in those countries. And whatever information sent to Africa is going to be garbage in, garbage out. When you look into our national televisions in Africa, when you look into radio, when you look into any other media, they rely heavily on what comes from America and the Western power. And by implication, it is the Western power, it is the Western European countries that are satisfying America's ambition in Africa. It is only recently that the narrative has been changing. I believe you know what's happened in Mali, in Niger, and in Burkina Faso, to the extent that those three countries, they formally excuse themselves from the economic community of West Africa, because they know that this is an institution that is controlled by the Western power. That is one. Number two, they've been caged for several years from 1960. Until say 2 or 3 years ago, when they disengaged from France. Think of a scenario whereby your foreign reserve to the tune of 85% to be with Paris Reserve Bank. And you know what happened to uranium in Niger? It's because of the misinformation from the Western world that continue to affect the development of Africa. So immediately African countries realize what is going on in the international system, the better. But how can they do that when the political leaders are still dancing to the tune of the Western world, when their illicit, ill-gotten wealth are kept in Switzerland, in Britain, in France, in Germany, in America, even in Canada? So you cannot say that the African countries are going to see the light at the end of the tunnel as for now. So that is the problem that we are contending with in Africa. Thank you very much.
Well, as we wrap up this discussion on Vladimir Putin's interview with Tucker Carlson, it's clear that the future does remain uncertain. In fact, while we may not have all the answers, our conversation with Mr. Minkatokiso Kubaye and Professor Larry Amosan has provided valuable insights into the economic and political realities that shape our very own world. Remember, the analysis presented here is simply one piece of this complicated puzzle. I want to encourage everyone to continue exploring diverse perspectives, delve deeper into the information presented, and of course, form your own informed opinions. To backtrack on other episodes, check out AfroVerdict on other podcasting platforms like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Deezer, Pocket Casts, AfriPods, Castbox, of course, and Podcast Addict. To stay on top of news on the continent and around the globe, make sure to follow Sputnik Africa on Telegram, TikTok, and other socials. That's that for today's episode, everyone. This is your host, Victor Anakin, signing off for the weekend. I'll see you right up next week.
Afro Verdict, brought to you by Sputnik Africa.